Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Monday, the 11th of November, these are our main stories. The Bolivian president, Evo Morales, has resigned after losing the support of the army following last month's disputed election. And as we record this podcast, with almost all votes counted in Spain's general election, the Socialist Party has won the most seats, but again has fallen short of a majority. Also in this podcast, the drunken man rescued from a Russian river who had been trying to dispose of his murdered lover. And as Sesame Street turns 50, we reflect on the TV show's groundbreaking appeal with an actor who was one of its human faces for most of that time.
I had never seen people of color on television. I was thrilled when I was cast as Maria to be a role model for kids who were like me.
We begin in Bolivia. Chants there of "Yes, we could" from crowds in Bolivia's main city of La Paz shortly after the president, Evo Morales, announced his resignation.
Oligarchic groups are conspiring against democracy. This is a historic development. It's outrageous. We know our history well. Nevertheless, I have the obligation to seek peace. It hurts to see Bolivians opposed to one another, to see that those people will lead us towards violence, towards aggression, towards a confrontation between Bolivians. And for this and other reasons, I am announcing that I'll be sending my letter of resignation to the Legislative Assembly of Bolivia.
Mr. Morales had faced heavy criticism and protests since last month's election, in which the Organization of American States identified clear manipulations of the voting system. On Sunday, the head of the armed forces, General Williams Kalimann, said Mr. Morales needed to leave in order to bring peace and maintain political stability. For the latest, I spoke to our South America correspondent, Katie Watson.
Evo Morales was a man who did change the political direction of Bolivia, the first indigenous president. He promised huge changes and he achieved a lot of them, social inclusion. When I was there, a lot of people said that Bolivians, for the first time in a long while, they feel proud to be Bolivian. The economy has done very well. But in the last few years, it's his democratic credentials that have been put into question and people concerned with his hold on power, especially after losing a referendum a few years ago on whether he could keep running. He lost that referendum, but, you know, he still wanted to run. So I think that was the concern that a lot of people had. And obviously we've seen his position became more and more untenable in the last 48 hours, but really since the elections last month.
So just to run through the fast pace of events in the last few hours, he was accused of manipulating the last election, and then the Bolivian military called for him to go, and then very quickly indeed, he was on a plane to Argentina.
Well, so what he's done is the report came out saying that there was manipulation, the results should be annulled. He said, yes, we'll do a new vote. But people didn't really buy that. They thought, well, you know, how do we know the next vote's going to be clean? So, yes, in a matter of hours, he has been put under pressure to resign. He has resigned. He flew, it's believed, to Cochabamba, which is where a lot of his supporters are. It's unclear where he is, but certainly Argentina has been thrown as one of the options because that's where there's a new leftist president where he has an ally. But at the moment, what we do know is he's resigned and is still, I believe, in Bolivia, but not in La Paz.
Our correspondent, Katie Watson. Monica Machikau works for the Reuters news agency in La Paz, and she told my colleague James Kumarasamy what she'd seen on the streets there.
It's an absolute feast. People are getting into the streets massively with this Bolivian flag. People are chanting, people are praying in the streets. They are mostly going into downtown right now to join the leaders of the civic representation, Luis Fernando Camacho and Alberto Pumari from the civic organizations of Potosí and Santa Cruz. Everyone is really, really happy and relieved because there was a lot of tension before the resignation of President Morales.
And the speed with which all of this happened, has it taken people by surprise?
Absolutely. absolutely. Nobody knew what was really going to happen today. Evo Morales gave a presser today in the morning, asking for the confirmation of a new electoral tribunal and also for new elections after the OAS gave an incredible report, a preliminary report, saying that there was no credibility of the results of the election. But we have to say also that the president was not allowed in order to call for an election. This is something that the assembly has to do. This is something that the Congress has to do. So Evo Morales wasn't even allowed to call for an election, but he did. In just a few hours, now he's resigning also with Vice President Garcia Linera. Right now they are still in Bolivia. They are at Chimoré, which is the center of the country where Evo Morales has all his farmers and the coca growers' headquarters.
Monica Machacao from La Paz with James Kumarasamy. If the people of Spain were hoping for clarity after Sunday's general election, the fourth in as many years, well, they'll be disappointed. Once again, no clear majority has emerged, even though the Socialist Party of the acting Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez will still be the largest single force in Parliament. So what are the options now? I've been speaking to our correspondent Guy Hedgeco in Madrid.
Pedro Sanchez, a socialist acting prime minister, he was the winner. His party has the most seats in Congress once again, and quite a clear winner. But as you said, he fell quite short of a majority. Now, the runners-up were the Conservative Popular Party. They made quite a few gains compared to the last election, but they were some way behind the socialists. The really big winners, arguably, however, were Vox, the far-right party, which had been the fifth force in Spanish politics after the last election. After this election, they're the third force. They've more than doubled their presence in the national parliament, and they really are the big winners with this election. The problem, though, as you say, is that there's no clear majority, either on the left or on the right. So it's not clear what's going to happen now, how Pedro Sanchez is going to form a new government is a question that's still hanging in the air.
So this could still lead to a change of government and a coalition between other parties that didn't come out on top.
Well, I think the most obvious route now would be for King Felipe to invite Pedro Sanchez as the winner to try and form a new government. But whether he can is the big question. Certainly looks as if he's unlikely to be able to form a left-wing government or an out-and-out left-wing government. There simply aren't enough seats from the left-wing parties in Congress as things stand. Now, there is a possible majority, a really clear governing majority in the shape of a sort of grand coalition between Pedro Sanchez's socialists and the Conservative Popular Party. But they are arch rivals. They've never worked together on a national level like that. They've never formed any kind of coalition or even governing partnership like that. So that would be unprecedented. But there has been some speculation that that could be a way of avoiding a third election in the space of 1 year.
Guy Hedgeco with me from Madrid. A drunken man being pulled from a river isn't usually a big story, but in the Russian city of St. Petersburg, the rescued man was carrying a bag which contained a woman's dismembered body parts. Oleg Sokolov is a well-known historian, and as we record this podcast, the body parts appear to belong to his lover, a former student. Mr. Sokolov has, according to his lawyers, confessed to murdering her. Sarah Rainsford reports from Russia.
It was a passing taxi driver who spotted the man in the River Moika and called St. Petersburg's emergency services. They arrived to find the 63-year-old professor, Oleg Sokolov, who'd apparently fallen into the water drunk as he tried to dispose of a woman's body. Investigators say he had two dismembered forearms in his rucksack. Other body parts were later discovered at his nearby flat. The professor had used a saw to cut up the woman who'd been shot. Multiple reports have identified her as the historian's former student and lover, who was 24. One report claims Professor Sokolov, who has a passion for historical reenactments, was planning to commit suicide dressed as Napoleon after he disposed of the body. So far, his motive for the murder isn't clear. The historian's lawyer suggests he must have been under some kind of heavy influence, as he put it, given that the crime was so unusual for a man he said was of such social standing. St. Petersburg State University has said it's shocked by the killing and has sent its deepest sympathies to the relatives of the victim.
Sarah Rainsford reporting from Russia. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Still to come.
We don't have any power, water or anything at our place. It's seriously damaged. But at least we've still got some belongings left. But a lot of people have just haven't got anything. So I've spent the day finding accommodation and vehicles and food and drink for people.
How the wildfires in Australia are affecting people in a small town in New South Wales. We'll talk to the mayor. It's a U-turn that could have a significant impact on the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. The US ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, has abruptly changed his testimony to Congress. The ambassador, whose brief has ranged beyond the EU's borders into Ukraine, now says that he did tell the Ukrainian authorities they'd have to investigate Mr. Trump's political opponents, the Bidens, if they wanted US military aid to be released. So, who is Gordon Sondland, and how is this hotelier-turned-diplomat viewed in the city where he has his current residence, Brussels? Gavin Lee's been finding out.
Hi, I'm Gordon Sondland, the new ambassador to the European Union. One of the purposes of this is to get you to know our family, starting with...
This is an excerpt from a Getting to Know You YouTube video that Gordon Sondland made last year, sitting on a couch with his wife, introducing himself as the 20th US ambassador to the EU, his first foreign posting and his political debut as an ambassador.
We're able to talk to people at all different levels of government. It helps bring about conversations that also help bring about change.
His own background has echoes of the president who chose him, a multi-millionaire hotelier and businessman who set his sights on a powerful political posting. He'd originally backed Jeb Bush for president in 2016, saying Donald Trump was out of touch with his personal beliefs on so many levels. But when President Trump was inaugurated, he donated $1 million to his inaugural committee. Soon after, he was made ambassador. His political patch also extended to Ukraine, which is not in the EU, and he split much of his time between Brussels and Kiev, telling reporters he'd been given a nickname by President Trump for his work there.
We have what are called the Three Amigos, and the Three Amigos are Secretary Perry, again Ambassador Volker, and myself. And we've been tasked with sort of overseeing the Ukraine-U.S. relationship between our contacts at the highest levels of the U.S. government and now the highest levels of the Ukrainian government.
It's his role in Ukraine that's put him in the spotlight as a key witness in the impeachment investigation into President Trump. This week, Ambassador Sondland abruptly changed his testimony to Congress, saying he now recalls telling a top advisor to the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid would not be sent to the country unless the Ukraine government announced an investigation that President Trump wanted into the business dealings of Hunter Biden, son of Democratic rival Joe Biden, and on the board of a Ukrainian energy firm, essentially a quid pro quo arrangement that he'd previously denied. This testimony adds credibility to the central accusation that President Trump abused his power in office by pressuring the Ukraine government to take action to help his 2020 presidential campaign. Donald Trump denies this. His profile here in Brussels, according to ambassadors and senior EU officials that I've met, paint a mixed picture of the man in the way he conducts himself and his professionalism. Impressions range from outward dislike for his style to some admiration. The civil servants we'll hear include a senior EU council diplomat, a Northern European official, and an ambassadorial advisor. All have asked for anonymity. Their words have been voiced by actors.
He talks in high tones. He's got a manner and a way about him that can rub people the wrong way.
I'll try to be diplomatic. All I will say is I like the old one much better than this ambassador. This one is not everyone's cup of tea, as you say.
He's aggressive. He's combative. Some people might say highfalutin. But he seems very open and you get where he's coming from. I know where he stands and respect that. I quite like him.
The official on-record view of Ambassador Sondland offers a different take. This is the chief spokeswoman for the EU Commission.
We've always had a good cooperation with him, and so from our side we have always experienced him as someone, a very professional counterpart who has been helpful in continuing our transatlantic cooperation.
Diplomacy at its most diplomatic. We've tried to speak with the ambassador this week and to his team here in Brussels, but Gordon Sondland and his advisers have been unavailable for comment. The impeachment hearings into Donald Trump continues next week.
Gavin Lee reporting. There's been an outpouring of anger in Sri Lanka after the departing president pardoned a death row inmate who in 2005 raped and murdered a Swedish-Sri Lankan teenager, Yvonne Johnson. President Sirisena said that Jude Jayamahu, who's from a wealthy, high-profile family, had behaved himself in prison and had been jailed when he was 19 over what he described as an incident of impatience. Yvonne's sister, Caroline Johnson Bradley, has posted an immediate response in an open letter to President Sirisena on Facebook. Here's a short extract read by one of our producers.
President Sirisena, I am writing this letter to you, but I am fully aware you may never read it. I cannot begin to understand how a father of two daughters reached a decision to release this monster. Now that you have once again inflicted this unbearable pain on my family, I think we and all the people who have expressed concern with the recent events deserve to know the true reasons you involved yourself in this case.
Yvonne Johnson's sister Caroline there. For more details of the case and the reaction to it, here's Dilma Givering in Colombo.
Some astonishment here that the president has taken it upon himself to issue this presidential pardon. It's largely controversial, I think, because so many people know so much about this case. They find it hard to see that this is a good example of highlighting patience, which was what President Sirisena was saying when he first mentioned that he was looking at a pardon. He made a speech just recently where he was talking about the importance for young people of tolerance and patience, and he told an anecdote from his own childhood about when he'd been particularly patient. And then he, in the same breath, as it were, he mentioned this case and said that this was the example of what can happen when a young man who's 19 can be very impatient. And some people felt that was a gross underplaying of a very brutal rape and murder. Part of the argument in supporting his release seems to be that his parents have fought very hard, saying that he's been rehabilitated, that he's repented, that he completed a PhD in prison. But as I say, people who followed the case and were shocked by the details of the murder are rather astonished that he's taken it upon himself to do this.
John McGivering in Colombo. The bushfires, which have been burning a swathe through parts of eastern Australia, causing deaths and leading to hundreds of people being displaced, have largely affected rural communities. But as we record this podcast, they're now encroaching on the region around Sydney, the country's largest city. Greg Allen is a spokesperson for the New South Wales Rural Fire Service.
Already since the 1st of July, we've had more than 915,000 hectares burnt. Now, to put that into perspective, that's more than the entirety of the previous two seasons. So more than 915,000 hectares have now been burnt with the fires that have been burning since the 1st of July. And as we move into the next few days, dangerous conditions are forecast for Tuesday. And this is, in fact, the first time that we've seen catastrophic fire danger forecast for the Greater Sydney region. So with the population in the millions around that Greater Sydney region, it's the first time that we've got to that level since the current fire danger rating system has been in place since 2009. So it's a first, it's going to be very dangerous, and there will be a lot of people that may be affected.
The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, has been touring the area and praised the Aussie spirit.
They're also telling me stories of incredible community where people have reached out, got people out of homes, made sure they got to safety, looked after each other's livestock and animals, talking to each other, putting themselves in harm's way for each other. I've got to tell you, as a Prime Minister, I'm never more proud of Australians than in moments like this.
At one of the briefings being held by the Prime Minister, he was heckled by a local resident, Harry Creamer, who addressed the media afterwards, accusing Australian politicians of ignoring the evidence of scientists who say climate change is making Australia's fire season longer and more intense.
We've been telling the politicians the same message for over 10 years, and they are not listening. We have a Prime Minister and a Premier in denial about climate change. This is real. Only on Thursday, 11,000 scientists issued a very simple 4-page statement saying we have to declare a climate emergency. The planet is at the stage where we must declare a climate emergency. You cannot leave it any longer.
Let's hear from one of those communities. Carol Sparks is the mayor of Gleninnis, a small town in New South Wales, where two people are known to have died and several others have been admitted to hospital, including one of her close family members.
We are quite safe, all of us, except for Storm's partner, who is in hospital in Sydney in the North Shore Hospital with serious burns. That's my granddaughter, and she's going down tomorrow, flying down to Sydney to see him with her baby. So, yes, that's on a personal level. On a community level, the people are absolutely devastated. Many of them have lost their homes. There's been about 40 houses lost. We went through an absolutely terrifying time on Friday and again on Saturday. The weather had changed, the wind died down a bit and the heat was a bit less intense, but we're expecting serious fire outbreaks on Tuesday, and already Sydney is under threat, so everybody's under great pressure here in Australia.
And where are you now? You're not at home, are you?
No, we don't have any power, water or anything at our place. It's seriously damaged. But at least we've still got some belongings left. But a lot of people have just haven't got anything. So I've spent the day finding accommodation and vehicles and food and drink for people.
And how difficult has that been?
It's very difficult because being the mayor, I have to make sure that everybody in the community's cared for. And we've got fires all around us. It's absolutely horrifying.
And fires come regularly in Australia, but I guess no one can be prepared for this level of intensity.
The dryness is totally different to what it has been in the past. And we've got no water, hardly any water to fight with. So we're really struggling to keep houses and our farms and keep our assets all away from the fire. So it's really horrible.
Obviously, at the moment, your priority is the immediate future and the safety of the community. But is this making you think the way you are describing this and the choices that you and others are going to have to make in the future seem to be quite stark about whether or not this is a safe place to live?
Absolutely. Some people haven't even seen their devastated house yet, so
have you had the chance?
I have had the chance. I went down on Saturday. My husband and I eventually made it to our house. We had to wait for trees are falling all over the place. Our trees are dying. Our eucalyptus trees are dying. And, of course, being burnt, they're falling over onto the road. So we've had to wait for the roads to be cleared. Our bridge blew up, so access to the property has been very difficult. But we did get in, and the house is brick, so some of it is still standing and some of our belongings have been saved, but the roof's off and there's no water.
So you and others are now thinking really about your future?
Yes, we are. And I've spoken to quite a few people about that today, and a lot of us are getting older and, you know, it's quite a tough existence out in the bush. You have to be strong and well, and if you can't manage that, then you're better off to leave. So we're sort of grieving the loss of our friends, and you know, we're also grieving that we may have to leave the community.
Carol Sparks, the mayor of Gleninnis in New South Wales, with James Kumarasamy. Do you recognise the familiar uplifting theme tune of Sesame Street, the groundbreaking and highly successful children's TV show that's just turned 50? half a century of having fun with spelling and counting, while also breaking down barriers between races and between humans and Muppets, of course. From Big Bird to Elmo to Oscar the Grouch and the Cookie Monster, the cast list is familiar, and the programme now has versions in more than 150 countries. James Kumarasamy's been looking back at its history with Professor Joe Blatt, a senior consultant on the show, and one of its human stars, Sonia Manzano, who played Maria from 1971 to 2015.
My love affair with the show started before I was Maria. I saw it when I was a student at Carnegie Mellon University, and I was stunned when I saw Susan and Gordon on television because they were people of color, and I had never seen people of color on television. So it had a personal connection to me because I was born and raised in New York City and watched a lot of television like Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best and shows like that of the 50s. And I often wondered where those people really lived and who they were. And certainly on some level thought how I was going to contribute to a society that didn't see me. So when I saw Susan and Gordon, I was thrilled. And then doubly thrilled when I was cast as Maria to be a role model for kids who were like me.
And Joe, was it a success from the word go?
Pretty amazing, actually. Before the end of the first season, Big Bird was on the covers of Time magazine and Newsweek. And I think Sesame was the hottest cocktail party topic of the year.
Sonia, did you think you'd be on that level? Like you talked about that everyone on set saying, oh, yeah, millions and millions of people are watching.
No, we never knew that we were going to go on and on. Every 5 years we'd say, okay, this is it. We're not going to get renewed. We're sure that this is going to be the last two. And all of a sudden, well, my time on the show, 44 years passed, and it still continues to go on. And all over the world, as you know, which is remarkable because it has such an American sensibility.
I was going to say, what is it that's made it the show that has been translated into so many languages and remade around the world? What do you think it is?
Every time Sesame partners with broadcasters in another country, they bring in local educators. They find out what are the issues facing children in that country. And in addition then to, you know, letters and numbers, the curriculum embraces what you really might call indigenous needs brought to it by local people. And I think that's absolutely pivotal to its success. You know, it's on now in 150 or more countries around the world, and you can't get there just by translating and exporting. You really have to embrace local culture and local needs.
And some of those issues are sensitive ones. South Africa had a character who's HIV positive, for example.
Just right. And in fact, I really admire that Sesame has pursued sensitive issues, even in war-torn, really troubled areas like Israel and Palestine, like Northern Ireland, like Afghanistan and Kosovo.
And is it fair to ask both of you who your favorite Muppet is?
Well, Oscar the Grouch is my favorite. As a matter of fact, the short answer as to why I retired from Sesame Street is because 44 years is long enough for me to wait for Oscar to propose. He's by far my favorite because he's nuanced. I never knew if I was talking to an 8-year-old or a 44-year-old. He works on many levels. It was a joy to write for him because he's so negative, so he could always go to him when you needed a sense of drama.
Joe, it's harder for you.
Well, I won't say who my favorite is, but I will say that I identify the most with Grover, who's always trying so hard to make things clear and to be helpful and usually manages to fail. And I see a lot of myself in that.
The Harvard professor Joe Blatt and Sonia Manzano, who played Maria on Sesame Street. And that's all from us for now. There will be an updated version of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition of the podcast, do drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name's Andrew Peach. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Brought to you by Capital One, where you can open a savings account in about 5 minutes and earn 5 times the national average. Just imagine, 5 times more savings toward that overdue home addition. Maybe even an addition on that addition. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.